My hope is that your takeaway will be some ideas of how to care for yourself and care for others in the unique historical period that we're living in. And we have various proximities to these things, various proximity to the pandemic, various proximity to war. So there'll be slightly different things that'll be takeaways for each of us. A little bit about me. I'm a professor in marriage and family therapy at Wheaton College. Specialize in thinking about suffering and making my students suffer. So it's a good combination. So I feel like I might have something to say about this. I've been coming to Central and Eastern Europe for the last 10 years, working with Christian mental health professionals and how we kind of support each other in difficult times and navigating the suffering that we see around us and the historical implications of things that have marked us and marked our societies. So today we're going to try talking about survival and maybe even flourishing if we get lucky. I'm going to start out with resources right away from Wheaton College. We have a Humanitarian Disaster Institute at the college, and it's involved in all sorts of human disasters. It actually partners with us in the psychology department in terms of providing a trauma certificate. It's not a traumatizing certificate, it's a trauma certificate in terms of how do we deal well with trauma. And the courses involve a family therapy approach to looking at trauma. And it's not necessarily just relational, but thinking systemically. So thinking about, rather than the individual as the focus, thinking at dyadic and larger systems as the focus of trauma and suffering, and then looking at healing and health through that. Our Christian mental health counseling program looks at the individual, and then HDI looks at the larger systems. This came from Jamie Ayton back during Katrina, the flood that we had in the lower part of the US. And he went down and did some work there, and from that work with traumatized citizens, came up with this institute and has been receiving awards from the US president. And it's a fairly significant resource for both the church and society. So you can see the disasters are one of the biggest moral and biblical justice issues that we're facing, both in the church and in society, in terms of resources that get allocated, who the resources get allocated to, how we navigate that, and the stressors that it puts on church, on kind of marginalized people. And what we can do as believers to prepare ourselves and then help equip others. HDI is an example of an organization that works around the globe to equip people and the church to serve the underserved, the vulnerable populations, and ones that are especially disadvantaged by disaster. And so war, pandemic have been two of the big things. HDI has spent a lot of time in the last 2 years providing resources for the church on the pandemic. I don't know if you noticed, but the church seemed to get a little bent out of shape about masks and vaccinations, and it became kind of another schism, at least in the States. I don't know about here in Central and Eastern Europe and in Western Europe, but I had a pastor that came in to talk to me, and he was very despondent. And the reason he was despondent is his mother, who had grown up in the church that he was now the pastor of, refused to go to her son's church and left the church because he didn't trust God enough and had everybody wearing masks and went to virtual worship. And so he had the pandemic issue and trying to think about how do we live Christianly and charitably to those that may think and see things differently and be caring for those that are at risk and health-wise. He was trying to navigate all of that, navigate the US political beliefs that are connected to this. And then he had his mom saying, you don't have enough faith, and I'm not going to worship under your leadership, and I'm going to a different church that after being here for 80 years. So this is real pain that people are struggling with and trying to figure out a combination of societal health and then family dynamics that are going on that are creating what we're seeing as a big almost new pandemic of mental health issues and relational issues, specifically around isolation. And if we think theologically, our theology suggests a triune God that is relational, not only in and of himself, but he pursues us in relationship. So relationships matter. And the last 2.5 years has been organized towards isolation. And now we're seeing that in displacement during the war. And so we're struggling against kind of how we were designed, what were we designed for, and how are we navigating this? So HDI is a resource. The website's on the bottom there. If you go to Wheaton College's website, you can find HDI, Humanitarian Disaster Institute. They have these resources on the resource page. And I just thought I would show you because depending on where you're working, if you're with an NGO, if you're with a parachurch organization, a business, a church, these are 1 to 2 page documents that are really helpful in giving an aim. So the aims are assessing survivors' mental health. So thinking about displaced people, thinking about people that have survived the pandemic. The aim is to help you assess where they are mental health from a lay perspective, not from a clinical perspective, but from a church ministry perspective or a NGO perspective. Listening and attending skills, right? God gave us 2 ears, 1 mouth. That's what I would write on the sheet of paper. We're supposed to listen twice as much as we talk. They have it a little more scientific on their sheet. So you can go through looking at the posture for engaging in justice work, kind of from a biblical justice perspective, slow kingdom coming, ethical storytelling. I'd encourage you to look at those resources. So the first start of surviving is you need to identify your coping and style and strength. And we all kind of fall into 2 different categories, and it comes from the families we grew up in. There's families that deal with crisis really well. They organize. Have you seen these families? That there's a crisis and man, they're organizing a food train and they got things going and they're really good in a crisis in a short-term kind of response. And those are the sprinters, right? The coping, like we can sprint. But if it goes past a few weeks, if it goes into months and years, that coping strategy ends up being a risk factor because they can't sustain that level of adaptation to the environment. So really good in a crisis, horrible in a chronic situation. And the converse is true. There's families that fall apart and individuals that fall apart in the crisis, but man, they can do the long haul really well. They can do the marathon running. So knowing where you are and knowing where your family is and maybe where your church is really important to know when are we working from our strength and when is it going to be a risk factor that we have to attend to. So maybe during a crisis, everything's okay. And as a leader, I need to be mindful of the next 3 or 4 months. If this continues, we're going to have to give special attention to the needs of our congregation because we do this well and then this will be the exhaustion, the burnout part. Conversely, we might need to get resources in here to deal with the crisis time, and then we're going to be great for our community in the long term. So it's getting a sense, and I think we all kind of have a sense of, in your life, do you do better with short-term crisis or do you better with the long-term chronic? And we can think about that illness too, right? I am a horrible like person when I get a cold. Oh, I'm dying. But, some broken bone or something that takes a long time, I'm going to find ways to adapt and continue life with that pain. And it's just bizarre. It's just like, come on. But it's this kind of idea of coping strategy and what works for you. So hopefully you can think about, are you a sprinter or are you a distance runner? And you're going to navigate crises of pandemics, war, personal issues differently and need different resources based on your coping style and strategy. We see this with the Israelites. The Israelites were sprinters. Right? And so they were great at sprinting. They get out of Egypt through the river, through the sea, and they're traveling and they have the song of Moses and Miriam and wonderful. And we're just having a party because we just got out of slavery. And then we come to the well of Mara, the bitter, bitter water. It's like, why are we here? It was 3 days. We managed to do well for 3 days, and then the long haul of suffering and complaining. It's better to go back to slavery, right? So we kind of see this coping mechanism that's good to the, like, yeah, we could get out of Dodge and kind of get across the sea, and we're happy about it, but then, you mean we have to deal with this every day? And I'd rather be like just getting a little food every day and know what I'm getting than deal with this unknown over a long period of time. So great in the crisis, grumbling in the longer process. McCubbin in the 70s and 80s started to look at stress and how we develop our stress response. And there was first the ABX stress model and the double ABX. If this was a class, I'd spend a lot of time on this. I'm just going to highlight that we have stressors that happen, and this is mutual influencing. So it's not linear, like we have stresses, resource, and then it's a crisis or not. It's we have stressors that happen. We have meaning making, family's kind of description and perception of the stress. So it's something happens. We have a belief about that. We have a view about that. So whether it's the pandemic or war, right? The event is one thing. Our belief as a system, church, family, individual, affects how we experience that stressor. It also affects the resources that we access, that belief, and the stressor and the resources that are available. So these are all mutually influencing each other to give us a sense of crisis. Or not. So you can have people that have really difficult things happening to them, and they don't consider it a crisis. There's a strength in surviving it because the stressor's the same for everyone, but the belief and the resources that they have available lead to it either being a problem or being something that is meaningful. Like meaningful suffering is experienced differently than feeling intrusive suffering. Right? So if I talk about it, like, this is happening to me and there's nothing I can do about it. And even when I have some resources, I don't know if this is going to continue to happen to me. That's a crisis because of the meaning making that goes on with it. If it's, everybody's going through this and we'll be okay, we have the resources, that same event's going to be experienced differently. And we can see, can't we, cultural responses happening differently. Between Poland and Hungary and Czech Republic and Romania and Bulgaria, all the bordering, and Slovakia, all the bordering countries are having different responses to the crisis of whether it's a crisis or not. I would argue it's part of what's happening in McCubbin's system here, that the situation is the same for everyone. The belief system about what that is and how vulnerable are we, does this affect us, how do we make meaning of it, what's the spiritual implications, what resources do we have, for instance, how much Russian oil are we dependent on? That's a resource and that has meaning making that's gonna lead this to a sense of struggle or not, a sense of crisis or not, that's gonna be different. So the challenge for us in helping people survive pandemic, war, all these type of situations that they experience either as crisis or not, is going to be about these three things. The stress event, which is common to everyone, the meaning making, scriptural meaning making, kind of theological meaning making, personal, societal, country, and then the resources that are available. So you can kind of understand Hungary's challenge. If all of your resources are coming from Russia, then making a stand that way is a whole different crisis than, say, for Poland or for the UK or for the US, where the US is like, we'll just stop buying everything. Well, it was like 4% and you're thousands of miles away. It's different, right? It's a different experience. Now, there might be emotional meaning that heighten it in a different way. But does this help kind of frame how there can be so many different responses to a crisis and we don't have a frame to think about it? For me, this helps me then think and be able to respond differently across cultural and family and even churches' responses to then kind of problem solve. Because then we have this crisis leads to then a piling up. Sorry about the fuzziness there. Well, I should put on my glasses. Maybe it's clear to you. It's fuzzy to me. It's a pileup of stress. So stress isn't just a single thing. Remember the pastor, right? It's the pandemic, and it's the history of the church. There's the politics, and it's his mom. All of those things go together, and that's the double ABX. So we have the first event, and then we have everything else that crisis then interacts with, that we have meaning making about, that we have resources about, that we either have good coping strategies or not, that then give us a whole nother level of crisis with that pile up from the one event to now, wow, why are we so exhausted? Well, pandemic, war, our normal daily lives, work, depending on what your work is, all of that. And so McCubbin gives us a framework to think about this to help strengthen. Does this make sense? Helpful frame? Okay. So we want to look at types of stressors. We want to look at resources. We want to take those boxes and try to see, okay, how do we strengthen them? The types of stressors that we have, I like to think about them. I took the biology part out of it because we're not going to talk about bio unless there's anybody from the science network, and then maybe we can talk about biology. But there's psychological, relational, and situational. Psychological stresses, this is from Murthy and colleagues in 2006, some interesting things about psychological stress and how, depending on who we are, there's a greater likelihood of experiencing these events as stressful. And for the psychological stresses, in this domain, women from this study and other studies are more affected by psychological stress than men. It's an interesting thing that it doesn't mean that in this room all the women would be more stressed. It's that there's a probability, and we need to be thinking about this, that if we think about HDI, looking at more vulnerable populations or populations that would be more likely to struggle, this is something to think about. If there's psychological warfare, if there's psychological pressure, there is a possibility of different experience based on gender, and we need to be attending to that. There's a prevalence rate in connection to degree of exposure. How close are you to the war? How close are you to the story? Did it happen to you? Did it happen to a family member? Did it happen to a church member? Or did you just read about it on a blog? The proximity to the exposure matters in terms of whether you're going to be stressed psychologically. And then the resources that you have available. So degree of exposure and the resources available are going to mitigate whether this is going to be a stress to you or not. And then the resources that you have in terms of spiritual and relational coping strategy. We see that your faith, your spiritual disciplines individually, your corporate worship, your meaning making in terms of connection to a loving triune God, these resources are going to mitigate, they're going to be actually a mediating factor that they'll knock down the impact of the trauma and reduce the level of pressure from exposure. So for us as believers, we have this wonderful resource available to us. It doesn't mean that it's going to get rid of the suffering, but it means it's a resource that will help in determining the level of crisis that we're experiencing. The relational stress, Long and Patterson and colleagues, the biggest threat, if you learn nothing else, isolation is poison to human beings. And isolation right now is the largest poison. Whether you're being displaced or whether you're dealing with the pandemics. 2020 March in Prague, get a call from the college president. You need to come back now because they're shutting the borders on Friday. This was Thursday. So what do? I go on a walking food tour in Prague because I have flight for Saturday. Saturday's close enough to Friday, right? And then during the food tour, the president of the college calls and says, you need to come home now. And he's like, did you get a plane ticket? And I'm like, I'm just needing to finish this. It's Wheaton College, so I think I said beverage. And then we will get our tickets. We got home, right? And we were like, we have to be in quarantine for 2 weeks. And we're living, just our five of us in the room, in our family room together. And 2 weeks come up. And then that very day that we're released, the city shuts down. And all the grocery stores and restaurants close, and so we're in for the long haul. So to keep our sanity, we go for walks. And I'm sure some of you did this as well. Walking down the street through Wheaton College campus, and there's some people walking from the other side, right? On the same side of the street, we're about 2 blocks away, they cross the street. And I'm just like, ah. And Tara's like, oh, that's, you know, let's, and I'm like, no, watch this. And so then I cross on the other side of the street. So we're still on the same side of the street. Now we're only a block apart. And what do? They cross the street. And we get a half a block apart, and I kind of cross the street again. And my wife has just stopped standing back there going, I'm not having any part of this nonsense. But what was happening, besides me just being annoying, is what was happening was my existence as a person was a threat to this other, right? And we've had that data in the States about ethnicity and gender and threats. But this was everywhere, that your personhood became a threat to me that I needed to avoid. And children have been taught, others are a threat to your survival. Which we needed to have social distancing. So I'm not saying we shouldn't have social distancing, but think about that for a minute in terms of how we make meaning of social interaction. And it's better to be separate and safe than to be connected and in danger. For a short period of time, that's effective and helpful. Over the long term, again, we're not living in the image bearing of a triune God that's relational, and we're having serious emotional and mental and relational problems. We're going to talk in a minute about the prevalence of divorce, and it's directly linked as a crisis to the stress model of COVID. So let's jump to this. What did COVID require of us? As I was saying, it required social distancing, lots of behavioral change. I don't know if you all had behavioral change around COVID, but my life became very different. I taught online, rarely left my house, didn't have to wear like this. I could wear shorts, no one would know. There was some benefit to the behavioral changes, but there was also some detriment. There was isolation, there was perceiving others as a threat, there was reduced physical contact, no longer shaking hands. It's all like this or just like, there was this whole thing. Remember that season? We went through the elbows, and then there's the fists, and then there's just kind of like, hey, you know, don't touch me. We'll just kind of say hi. In our church, there was passing the peace, and it became this, which was kind of cool. Back to the 60s, like, yeah. And we passed the peace on screen, giving a peace sign, which, okay, but there's something about physical contact, and we know this, right? And there's something about physical contact I think we should think about in general in terms of surviving that's necessary. Like, we touch kids all the time, like squeeze their cheeks, kiss them, and they're like, oh, I could just eat you up, which is a creepy thing to say to a child. But we say that, and there's just it's easy to hug and love on them, and there's nothing. Then you have teenagers. Right, and there's all sort of awkward kind of touching, and it's like, but as we age, there's less and less touch. And I talk to people a lot, and people in my age in their 50s, 60s, 70s, really the only physical contact outside of their family is their healthcare provider. The times that we get touched is in our physicals and in medical intervention, but not at church. There's not a lot of physical touch. The data shows there's a release in oxytocin, 20-second hug, the attachment drug, and it's deeply helpful in terms of mitigating the effects of the steroidal kind of cortisol release in stress. But we've lost that in times when we need it. And even just in general, we've lost a sense societally, I think, of touch. Now, there's difference. When I go to Brazil, I have never been kissed as much ever. I speak at a church and I have like this much pancake makeup on. I could just kind of write my initials on my face because there's all sorts of kissing and touching. So there's a cultural norm about that. I grew up in Dutch culture, in the U.S. And so my uncle would hug me like this. And he'd just nod his head like, hi, David. And I'd give him a hug. And one Christmas I walked by him and didn't give him a hug. And he's like, what's going on? And I'm like, well, you've never hugged me back in like 20 years. So I figured we'd stop. And he's like, oh. So then I gave him a hug and a kiss. And he's like, get off of me. But how are we having human interaction? And where is that happening? These are things that change that we need to look at as things that help us survive and thrive and flourish as human beings. And we've started perceiving others. So it's not good to be alone, right? I don't have to exegete Genesis for you. We all know that story of that we're not meant to be alone. So we tend to gravitate towards people that are similar to us. So when we pick our bubble, it's not people that are really different from us. It's going to be people that are more similar than different, which can be helpful because we don't have to explain a lot of things and we can understand each other. But it can also be detrimental because then we only have one view. And if you think about that meaning making, if we have just a uniform view of what it is, and that's a negative view, there's no space for diversity of ideas and moving out. So needing to be able to interact beyond our normal kind of self-selected grouping can be helpful in navigating these traumas. So your social network is important. These will be Another thing, social support. This is one of the most important resilient factor in stressful events is, do you not only have people that you can connect with, but you experience them as supportive? And COVID restrictions disrupted this, so there's lack of spontaneity, the indirect, but there are also benefits because maybe the people that you care most about, you weren't around, like Stefan, your story, and it actually strengthened because you had social support. The reason that isolation was good was it was filled with social support and activities that you enjoy doing, which is a resilient factor. So we have to look at how do we build these in? If they're not there, how do we build these in? Because I don't know if we're going to ever go back into lockdown or not. I pray not. Except for Stefan. And then maybe, yes, maybe life will be good again. But we have, and humor can be helpful if you use it right. We also see your personality type. If you get energy from people, extroverted, isolation was difficult. And it was probably difficult on those that lived with you. Because it's like, what are you doing? What do you want to do? Do you want to, you know, I've been over here reading for 10 minutes by myself. Do you want to play cribbage? No, go read. So extroverts had a harder time and they wanted to, and they thought they were being support, like, oh, I'm doing support. Nope, you're just being annoying. Because it's not just the interaction, it's how is it experienced. And you need it to experience. And then spiritual, political beliefs impacted these social networks, like the pastor's mom, right? Of like, the meaning of doing this isn't kind of convicted civility and compassion, it's doubting God and I can't worship under you. And so that spiritual belief didn't lead to social support, it led to a fracture. So how are we building these in? Thinking creatively of how do we, when we come across people that are struggling with the pandemic, struggling from trauma of war, how are we building social network that is experienced as social support? Shared interest, finding those stories that are supportive and encouraging that provide hope, watching out for the stories that are gonna take us down together, because then the interaction is good, the social network is good, but the support isn't there because it's just re-traumatizing. Social interaction network, right? These are some of the things. What are the norms that are built into your life and how are they, how can they be adapted to the situation that you're in? And we talk about handshakes. I kind of talked about this. So what we lost and what our Ukraine friends have lost is the daily rhythms, the spiritual rhythms, the relational rhythms to life. And this is really important because, again, if you're a sprinter, you can probably adjust quickly to missing those rhythms. But then how long am I going to be displaced? And how are we as aid workers, how are we as churches thinking about, oh, not only food, shelter, how are we creating rhythms that are going to be helpful to navigate this as a resource living in a new community? Now, this is difficult, right? Because then you think about the communities that are welcoming in people. They tend to be a sprint oriented, like, oh, we're all going to gather at the border and bring you into our homes. And it's like, how long? No, I thought you were staying for 3 months. How long are you staying? And but then what do you do? It's like, okay, you can't stay here anymore, right? Then there's another displacement. But then I'm navigating stress of, well, my Airbnb, I'm not generating income, so I'm not going to be able to feed my family. So there's this secondary challenge that happens from the response to the primary. And where is our long-term, so short-term, right now we're still in the short-term phase in terms of responding to war. We're gathering resources. The long-term is gonna be how long that lasts, and the long-term is gonna be the rebuilding. Because it's not gonna be quick anytime soon. If the war ended today, praise God, it's still a long haul in terms of how are we going to do as a church in the long term, loving and caring and supporting. And it's a challenge for us to think about. So I was working with an aid organization and they were like, we're raising all this money for food and for, and there's actually too much right now. And I'm like, you might want to start a secondary fund. And you might want to start a secondary fund for the long haul, for mental health, and for rhythms in terms of places of worship and finding kind of traditional ways that are comfortable to the families that are living in your country, and about rebuilding. So there's the immediate funds, and groups were burning through that pretty quick. And can there be a sustained level of that kind of quick response? How long can it be? And where are we thinking about investment in the long term? So as we think about surviving the war, and as we think about like partnering with to survive the war, we have to think about sprint and distance. And we need a combination of that within the church for survival, for our own survival as caregivers, and for survivals of those that are displaced. Does this make sense? But it's not something that we necessarily, we're really about the immediacy and responding to the immediacy. And I think for health and meaning making, we need to think about both. That will help us in our stress level and help those that are more directly related. And that will build this sense of togetherness and belonging. Spiritual stressors, great Jeremiah passage, Jeremiah 16. Jeremiah is called into isolation, called into celibacy, won't have kind of a legacy of children. And so there's this kind of just cut off from community, cut off from this longer period of time. Can't go to funerals, weddings. It's a COVID response that we see happening in the 16th chapter. And it impacts his relationship with God. So if you read through that, he starts lamenting and accusing God. Now, it's not in a sinful way, but it's in a way that's built on the previous intimacy that he had, that he could just cry out. And I think for us, being able to sit with people or ourselves and have that lament and realize it's okay to have that depth of pain and question and struggle, especially if we have that secure relationship with God, there's space for that. And that's actually healthy and helpful. And so thinking about doing lament. The provost of Wheaton College is a poet. And she's been talking with us about using poetry to express. And she's like, we have a whole psalter of examples of David doing this, of how he navigated the trials and tribulations of his life. Is these songs and these poetry. And she's like, some people get upset by it. It's like, ugh, should you talk that way? But that was his internal life. That was his moment. And being able to share that allowed him to move to the next thing. And so for us, how comfortable are we in providing spiritual first aid that allows people to struggle and allows people to say things that we might, and they're like, I don't know if you should say that. That verges on heresy. But that's where their heart is right now. And it's not a permanent place. Can we be with them and witness that, hear the story, and work on that connection? Because what we see is that's really helpful. Because then what we see in Jeremiah is he goes on to having the hope on the other side of this messiness that is his life right now. And it's a hopeful book, but it's a painful book to read of what happens for him in isolation. And he has stressors of kind of challenges to the social norm, being in isolation versus in community, kind of questioning God, not sure he can trust God, not sure he can trust others, right? Here's all the social stressors that are going on for him. And then resilient factors, as he comes out, there is a community for him. I would wonder about, for us, as we think about building into this, how do we use technology to build community? I'm an in-person kind of person, so I just even saying that, kind of a little bile is in my mouth. I'm like, I love being in person. I hated teaching online. And yet, if we think about people that are on the margin that might not have access, technological resources of Zooming in, providing virtual support, can be the only support that they receive. I'm going to have to challenge myself about my aversion to technology. And I think, Stefan, you talked about that, of like it increased being able to do some online things, strengthened some relationships. And it's a resilience. I think maybe younger men like you have an easier time than old guys like me. But if we're doing distant work, right? Like if I'm in the States and yet can provide some mental health help in on the Polish Ukrainian border, I can't fly back and forth and keep my job. And so I'm going to have to kind of do that. And I think for us, how do we step outside of our comfort levels to think about providing spiritual and emotional, relational first aid? We're resourced a lot now. I mean, we all have these little computers in our pockets that I can call my family back in the States from Poland. My dad was like, "That looks like your living room." I'm like, "No, I'm in Poland." He's like, He looked at me like, "It's the same color paint." I'm like, "Well, okay." Two old men. "No, I'm in Poland." "Are you sure?" "Well, now I'm not sure. I don't know. I got into a tin can and 13 hours later, I'm somewhere else." But I think we have to think about using different mechanisms that we're not comfortable with, and maybe spiritual practices that we need to start looking into in terms of some of the early church father and mother's spiritual disciplines that help sustain during difficult times that maybe we need to go back to and look at, and how do we kind of implement those in our daily lives and then with others. Intimacy, these verses you can kind of look and read through. It's really quite interesting. Closeness and emotional connection fulfills vital human needs. It's vital for our mental health. Intimacy kind of can thrive during the first lockdown, but it also can fray. So you have to be curious. You can't just assume this happened and so this is what it's going to be. Assumption gets you in trouble. Trust me, as a clinician for 25 years, I've gotten into a lot of trouble. The worst therapy session I ever had was, it was a family from Western Michigan where I grew up, a Dutch American family, and I'm like, "Oh, I know them." And so, like, not really, but like the way they interacted, everything. So I made tons of assumptions. I didn't ask questions, and I got into a lot of trouble really fast because I wasn't curious, and I assumed what went on for me and my family was going to go on for this family. Now, other families that don't look like my family, I can be curious about. The danger is our church community, we might make assumption about it. We have to be curious because we can get into a lot of trouble just making assumption about how we're connecting and is it helpful or not. And so checking that out. This is just fun. The damage that's happening. Fun might not be the right word. Interesting is not the right word. This is disturbing facts. So in the UK, as of last month, the Life Project on the BBC listed out that divorce rates in and out of the church have risen by 122% in the UK. And of those, 76 have been initiated by the wives. So there's something going on here that has changed over the last 2 years. And it's affecting women more than it is. Remember our study back from 2006 that the psychological distress is going to be more likely affecting women than men? And here we're seeing the actuarial tables in terms of, and that's manifesting itself in breakdown of relationships in the UK. In the US, it's 34% increase since 2019. China divorce rates has doubled in that same time period, pre-COVID to now. And in Sweden, it was actually on a decrease, and now, yay, it's back on an uptick. I mean, as a marriage therapist, this means job security. I was hoping to work myself out of a job, and who knew? I'm never going to retire. So that's some of the COVID things. We've talked a little bit about war. I want to get to the final first aid thing. So this is just, we've had COVID. Then we add stress from war, especially if you live in Russia, in the Ukraine, in the border countries of Russia and Ukraine, that war stress and trauma are going to be more proximal and will be creating more anxiety, fear, and stress. There's vicarious trauma. A pastor, Gorski, I forget his first name, just emailed me and said they had a council. He's a Ukrainian pastor that set up a church in Ukraine in Poland about 4 years ago. And he's like, "I don't know why God wanted me to have a Ukrainian church in Poland that started in 2018. Guess what? Now I figured out why. It's fascinating, but they've gotten church leaders together, and one of the more important things is that they're seeing for a lot of the Polish friends of the church are struggling immensely because they're hearing all of these stories, they're seeing the damage, seeing the people. The trauma is vicarious, but it's still proximal. It's very close to them. And so they've been talking about how are we going to change their hours of work. So even though there's these people and there's a need to work, needing to change the hours, so there's about as many hours on as off, and taking them from, you know, 30 miles or 50 kilometers away from the border to have some rest that's nowhere near where they've experienced the trauma. And having groups of people, so you have mental health professionals that are helping that are getting stressed, and then you need another group of mental health professionals to help the mental health professionals. Because this vicarious trauma that's happening. And we can do some things to prevent it, but it's just realizing you can only hear so much. And it leaves a mark on us, and needing to care for those as well. So there's these ripple effects that happen. And then displacement, there's countries that are taking on, and the governmental systems that are taking on displaced, that are creating stress, financial stress, the increase in resources needed, and the kind of the all the socioeconomic issues that are going on. It's really complex, and I worry about the long run of how governments and how our tendency as human beings from a clinician perspective is when we're under stress, it's easy to other. So managing my anxiety, it's much easier if it's your fault and then I can respond to you. If it's just I have to sit with my anxiety of like, are we gonna have any energy when I turn on the stove, will it work? It's because of those Americans. And it's easier to other a people group, right? We've seen that historically as we are here in Europe, of it was the Jews in 39 when there's economical strain and people groups being displaced and the tension build, and it's like, and then it's easy to other. Right now, everybody's coming together and supporting Ukrainians. I worry as stress builds, economic stress and kind of population stress, that there'll be an othering. So I think part of what we need to do as a church is really be mindful of that, of how do we sit, how do we lament, how do we hold on to our discontent and our struggle and our anxiety and process it in ways that's not othering. And that's preventative work that we can do. Daily living, you all know this, your life stress, job stress, okay, during COVID, then you also have heart issues, but you're not going to go in because, you know, COVID is there, so you put off your health care, and now we're having huge amounts of cancer and heart issues because there's been 2 years of not attending to regular medical care. All of these pile up. It's so much fun. It's cumulative. So what can we do relationally? What can we do spiritually? This is one of the things that Jamie and his team have produced out of HDI, and it's a really simple way that helps us ask the right questions, especially around spiritual first aid. And I think I'd like to end on this, and then have some time for questions. So belonging, livelihood, emotional, spiritual, and then safety. Belonging is relationship. Like, do you have a sense of, even if you're displaced, do you have a sense of belonging, like connection, relationship, secure attachment, feeling safe in those relationships? And providing social support, spiritual support, asking questions about that, of what are you needing relationally? What are you needing in terms of feeling supported by the church, by our agency? So there's these relational questions we need to ask, and that's belonging. Isn't it nice that it's bless? It's easy to remember, right? Let's bless each other. Focus on belonging. Second is livelihood. This is really taking an inventory of losses, of like, help me understand. You could, I suggested to Jamie, he called this lament, but he wanted all of them to be positive. I'm like, it's not positive. Right? Surgery sometimes is a necessary first aid. But it's this livelihood is how much energy do you have? So the response is, how are you lamenting to let that out so that you can have some vibrancy and some livelihood? And so connecting to a faith-based and community resources to be able to tell your story, to be able to cry and to say things that maybe aren't societally acceptable, or acceptable in our church? Can we sit with people that are just swearing like sailors? Because that's the best way to express it. Or it's like, oh no, don't sin, right? Because I've seen some of my counselors do that. It's like, oh, well, I understand you're in pain, but you probably shouldn't say that. Well, guess what happens? Wah, wah, wah. There's the end of that being supportive, because there's a sense of shame now that I feel this way, I've expressed it, it's been wrong, and so I don't meet up. And shame can be really toxic. We're all of a sudden, we're not doing first aid. We've actually contributed to the problem. So can I let you lament? Can I be with you, even if it's abhorrent to me? Because the purpose isn't about your behavior, it's about me being with you and letting you lament to have a sense of relief. I was talking with Steffi, and I think about this a lot, whether it's emotions or lament, it's like a beach ball, right? Beach ball, do you know, like the big, very light, like just 5 grams, nothing. I hold it under the water. I can only do that for like 36 seconds. And then my arms shake and it pops up to, you know, fall over in the water. The kids laugh like Stefan is. They think it's hilarious, but 5 grams, I can only hold for 36 seconds. But when we're playing, batting it around, using it as it's supposed to be used, all day long, I don't get tired. Well, our emotions are like that. If we push them down, it takes so much energy. So the vibrant kind of first aid is we're needing to play with them. We're needing to use them as they were meant to be used. We're needing to express them between each other. And there's an energy that comes. There's a liveliness that comes from that. Emotional distress, that's continuing on. So there's lament about the situation that I can kind of then, okay, now we can move forward. And then there's a lament about the emotional, like, I think I want to die. I'd rather die. I just want to go back. So my question, and I hope your question would be, tell me what's happening emotionally. Asking the questions about your emotional life. Spiritual indicators, there's the existential questions. If they ask you spiritually existential questions, don't answer them. The answers aren't what they're looking for. The struggle is important, and being with them in the struggle, in the spirit, like how could a loving God do that? Yeah, let's read Job together. Because that's not gonna answer the question. Job's left without any answers. But his counselors, first 7 days, spectacular. I wish it stopped right there, because then I could have a biblical template for counseling. The friends, the 4 friends, they're great. They sat quietly and just sat with him and were in the pain. I mean, they did the bless, right? And then they opened their mouths. And how did they open their mouths? Well, they went back to the Proverbs of this linear idea of, well, you're suffering, so it obviously must be something that you've done. Because the Hebrew kind of thought process in terms of Proverbs is this linear causal. You did this, so this happened. Or if you do this, blessings will happen. But we get to Ecclesiastes, that wisdom literature, and everything is hevel, right? Everything is smoke and mirrors and vapor. And so it's like, it translates in English as meaninglessness. But it's like, have you tried to grab vapor? You see it there, you feel it, it's gone. So how do we balance out this kind of Proverbs idea of like everything's linear, like you're suffering because something you've done, or you're blessed because something you've done, versus nothing really matters. And then we get to Job, and there's other forces at work that we're part of, but that we have no idea of why the accuser and God Almighty are having a debate about God's worthiness based on Job's behavior. But Job has no part of that. He doesn't know. He's just suffering. There's nothing he's done. He's right. He could face God's face and say, hey, what's up? I'm righteous. This Proverbs thing, not working for me. And if it's this Ecclesiastes thing, I'm done. I'm tapping out. So what's up? Right? And that's where we left with Job. Can we sit? Can we be those first 7 day counselors and go, yeah, I'm with you? Because there's not necessarily an answer, especially with what's happening right now. We can come up with answers, but they're not satisfying, and that's not the point. Can we struggle together and acknowledge, this is horrible, I don't know, and we have a loving God who's in control? It's still bad, My favorite theologian, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the first service that we allow to each other in fellowship consists of listening. Just as love to God begins with listening to His Word, right? God speaks to us through His Word. We listen to Him through His Word. We learn about who He is and who we are by listening to His Word. So the beginning of love for others is about learning to listen to them. Listening can be greater service than speaking. And there's a type of listening, a kind of listening that's impatient. This is the one I do with my wife. I'm waiting for her to finish talking so I can make my points. I know I'm the only one that does that, so I see everybody smiling like, wow, you're a horrible human being. But there's this type of listening that's impatient, attentive. Come on, get on with it because I have a rebuttal. And then we respond to what we've made up in our head and we haven't heard what they've said. That's really about getting rid of the other person, right? So are we listening to people that are struggling with the pandemic responses, struggling with war, daily life, and we're just like, yeah, move on because I want to tell you what matters. Well, that's getting rid of them, and that's not the love that we see of the Father. We are broken people. We do harm. We struggle. We hurt those close to us. So what do we deserve? Bonhoeffer refused to judge his jailers. He knew that they were broken people in the midst of their own suffering. This freed him up in bondage. This freed him up to respond differently instead of returning pain to pain for pain. In the Netherlands, I went to Camp Vught, where the Phillips family was held, and talked with some of the people there that had been held in Camp Vught. And they said, when we were released, half of us grabbed all the Dutch collaborators and put them in and treated them the way we were treated, because that was justice. But one Dutchman told me, he's like, you know, we're doing the same thing, just with a different reason. And so out of our pain, we responded exactly in the way that we didn't like how we were treated. And so how do we in our pain respond that glorifies God rather than become the same pain giver that we're wounded by already? And for Bonhoeffer, it's seeing that, oh, we all are in pain. And that frees me up to respond as an act to God rather than your worthiness. And that's a strong spiritual time. So these are all there for you. The last bit is what we've done today. You've talked with each other about it, right? You've all done spectacular in the first aid because you listened to me the whole time. It was great. You've listened to each other. You had a shared sense of similar experiences of a difficult time, as well as seeing differences that can provide hope. Other things that we want to work with is regulating sleep. Regular sleep is so important. And sleep without any kind of sleep aid, so Ambien, Tylenol 4, these things are short-term solutions that actually have cascade effects that will not help you have regular sleep in the long run. So if you're looking for marathon running, finding sleep patterns in terms of maybe milk, music, rituals, regular bedtime that can be helpful, prayer, finding disciplines that can help you, if not fall asleep, of rest at a regular pace so that you have a rhythm. Because there's this historic pattern in the church that we can learn from of rhythms of life, rhythms of season. We have the Sabbath keeping as a rhythm to enter us into an experience of eternity every week. This rest, this space with God that's separate from the daily grind. How are we building in self-care, rest, sleep, exercise? Exercise 20 to 30 minutes, 3 or 4 times a day is going to be a protective factor. It doesn't mean it makes things go away, but it's going to be something that's helpful. And it doesn't have to be rigorous, right? Look at me. You see, I don't do rigorous. And I actually have an allergy. I'm allergic to food. Look at how I swell up, right? That was from lunch. I was really skinny right before lunch, and then I had an allergic reaction. I don't know what happened. Thank you. You're a good audience. Good night. No. Limit information. I've noticed this. Everybody's Zoom or doom scrolling. We talk about this in the States. Doom scrolling. Do you have that here? It's where you're on Insta or you're on Facebook or I just need to know the next, like, what's happening, or news feed. What's happening? That hypervigilance is priming yourself for PTSD. And so maybe it's not that you don't need to know what's happening in the news, but maybe limit it to, I'm going to look at, you know, first thing in the morning, and then I'll wait until tomorrow morning. Because how is it going to change your life of the news that you see? Like, are you going to do something different, or is it just information? If it's just information, then free yourself up from that. Have it once a week, once a day, or once a week. And it's going to free up some of the emotional energy. Because you have to ask, how many? Service with and for others, doing something proactive, meaningful, back to our ABCX model of how do we have meaning of this? If we can make it meaningful, it's going to be a protective factor. And then asking for help. Jesus asked his disciples, go get the boats ready for me, and Mark, when he was being overrun by ministry. It's okay to ask for help. It's important to ask for help, even for us as caregivers. It's important to ask for help in terms of providing first aid and for ourselves.